But that's the way it is with the physics. For a long time, we'll have a rule which works excellently in an overall way that we can't, even when we can't follow the details, and then sometime we may discover a violation of the rule in some small way and not discover a new rule. Incidentally, from the point of view of basic physics, the most interesting phenomena are, of course, the new places, the places that don't work, not the places that do work, because there's where we'll discover new rules. Incidentally, the third way to tell if the ideas are right is a crude way, but probably the most powerful of them all, and that is by rough approximation. By that I mean you may not be able to tell exactly why Alekhine moves this particular piece, but you can roughly understand that he's gathering his pieces around the king to protect it, more or less. That's a sensible thing to do under the circumstances. So in the same way, we can understand nature more or less very often without being able to see what every little piece is doing in terms of our understanding of the game. Well, at first, the phenomena of nature were rapidly divided into classes. Classes like heat, electricity, mechanics, magnetism, properties of substances, chemical phenomena, light or optics, X-rays, nuclear physics, gravitation, meson phenomena, and so on. But the aim, of course, is to see nature, complete nature, as different aspects of one set of phenomena. And that's the problem of basic theoretical physics today, to find the laws behind experiment, to see if we can amalgamate these groups. Well, we historically have always been able to amalgamate the groups, but as time goes on, new things are found. We're amalgamating very well when all of a sudden X-rays are found, and then we amalgamate some more, and now mesons are found. So at any one stage of the game, it always looks pretty messed up. A great deal is amalgamated, but then there's all kinds of wires and threads hanging out in all directions, and that's the situation today, which I have to describe. For example, historically, examples of amalgamation are the amalgamation of heat and mechanics. The atoms in motion, when the more their motion is, the more the heat that the system contains. And so heat and temperature effects can all be represented by the laws of mechanics. Another tremendous amalgamation was the relationships between electricity, magnetism, and light, which are found to be all different aspects of exactly the same thing, which we call today the electromagnetic field. Still another amalgamation is the unification of chemical phenomena, the properties of various substances, and the behavior of atomic particles, which is in the quantum mechanics of chemistry. The question is, of course, is this always going to be possible? Is it always going to be possible to amalgamate everything and ultimately discover that this entire variety of the world is merely different aspects of one thing? Nobody knows. All we know is that as we go along, we find we can amalgamate pieces and then find pieces that don't fit and keep trying to put the jigsaw puzzle together. But whether there's a finite number of pieces and whether there's a border to this jigsaw puzzle or not is, of course, not known. And it will never be known until we find, if we do ever finish the picture. Now, what I want to do is to tell you today is to what extent this amalgamation process has gone on and what the situation is today in understanding basic phenomena in terms of the smallest set of principles. To put it another way, in simple manner, what are things made of and how few elements are there? It's a little difficult to explain the whole thing right off with the present view, so if you'll excuse me, I will first give a description of how things looked approximately in 1920. And then I have a few things to take out of that picture and correct. So if you'll excuse me, I first do it a little bit historically and set the situation up approximately in 1920, and then we'll fix it. Before 1920 even, the picture was something like this, that the stage on which everything went was the three-dimensional space of geometry, which was described by Euclid, and that things changed in a medium of time, that there was a thing called time which permitted everything to change, so that we have this stage of space and time. And the elements on this stage were particles, the atoms, for example, which had some properties. First, the property of inertia, which is that if they started moving, they keep on going in the same direction unless forces acted. And the second, then, is forces. So that these particles had inertia and forces. And the forces were of two varieties. First, there was an enormously complicated detailed kind of interaction forces which held the various atoms in different combinations in a complicated way, and which determined whether salt would dissolve faster when you heated the temperature up or slower. These were the interactions between the atoms, and they were not understood at all, and they were very complicated. An additional force that was known was a long-range interaction of a smooth and quiet attraction that varied inversely as the square of the distance, and which was called gravitation. It's called gravitation, and this law was known and very simple. Incidentally, why things remain in motion when they're moving, or why there's a law of gravitation, things like that, of course, were not known. Just a description of nature is what we're involved with here, and we haven't described, connected the things together. From this point of view, a gas was a myriad of moving particles, so that of the things that I described standing at the seashore before, there are several quick things. First, the pressure is a collision of the atoms with the walls or the whatever's in there. The drift of the atoms, if they're all moving more in one direction than on the average, then that's wind. The random motions, the internal motions, is the temperature or the heat. There are waves of excess density. If you have collected too many particles here, then they rush off from here and they push up piles of particles further out, and they push up particles, piles of particles further out, and so on. And this wave of excess density is sound, and so forth. So it was a tremendous achievement to understand so much. I described that in the last lecture. Well, what particles are there? There were 92 at the time. There were 92 different kinds of atoms ultimately discovered with different names associated with the chemical elements. And the next problem was, what were the short-range forces? Incidentally, I must say that in the meantime, other things were discovered. First, the stars and their properties. What are they? Second, electrical phenomena, light, the magnetism and light. It was discovered, incidentally, and I haven't time to tell how, that the stars were made of the same atoms as the stuff on the Earth, which made it easier to understand stars than it would have been otherwise. Now, the main problem, then, was the question of what determined the interaction forces between these atoms. Why does carbon attract one oxygen or perhaps two oxygens, but not three oxygens, and so on? What is the machinery of the interaction between the atoms? Is it gravitation? Do they stick together because everything sticks together by gravitation? The answer is no, the gravity is entirely too weak. But imagine a force analogous to gravity, varying inversely as the square of the distance, enormously more powerful, but having one difference. Gravity, everything attracts everything else. But now imagine that there are two kinds of things, and that this new force, which is electrical force, of course, that I'm describing, has this property, that likes repel, but unlikes attract. Then what will happen? With a tremendous force. Well, suppose that we have two unlikes that attract each other, a plus and a minus, and they stick very close together here. Now suppose we have another charge out here from a distance. Will it feel any attraction? Practically nothing. Because if the two are equal in their size, the attraction for the one and for the other balance out. So that there's very little force at a reasonable distance. On the other hand, if we get very close with this extra one, it's nearer to one than to the other of this little object, and then there becomes an attraction. And so you see, this is the reason why the atoms, which are electrically constituted of opposite plus and minus combinations, feel relatively little force when they're any reasonable distance, aside from the gravity, I mean. But when they come close together, they can sort of see inside each other that the thing isn't exactly neutral, and thus have a very strong interaction. So that the ultimate basis of the interaction between the atoms is electrical interaction. If we rub a few of the electrons, if we unbalance the... You see, of course, in normal nature, since this force is so enormous, all the pluses and all the minuses will come together in as intimate a combination as they can. That's you and I, that's stuff. Neutral, made of fine grain, enormously and strongly interacting plus and minus parts, all balanced out. Once in a while, by accident, we may rub off a few extra minuses or a few extra pluses. Usually it's easier to rub off a few extra minuses. And under those circumstances, we find the force of electricity unbalanced, and so we find electrical attractions that we discover on a large scale by rubbing your comb through your hair. To give you an idea of how much stronger electricity is than gravitation, I consider two grains of sand, say a millimeter in across, at each end of this room, 100 feet apart. And if the force between them, if the thing weren't balanced, if in other words, like everything attracted everything else instead of likes repelling, so that you didn't have the cancellation. How much force would there be? There would be a force of 3 million tons between those two. So you see that it takes very little excess or deficit of the number of positive or negative charges to produce appreciable electrical effects. That's incidentally why you can't see the difference between a charged, electrically charged thing and an electrically uncharged thing, because so few particles are involved that it hardly makes any difference. Now, the atoms were easier to understand. They had a nucleus at the center, which was electrically charged, and I might go ahead, a little ahead of my story to discover that in the nucleus there were two particles, protons and neutrons. They're almost the same weight, these two, almost the same mass, very heavy. The protons are electrically charged, the neutrons are neutral. Now, if you have a nucleus with, say, 6 protons inside, I don't care how many neutrons, say 6 if you want, then the negative particles in the world, of ordinary world of matter, are all electrons. And these are very light, and they sit around the outside, around this thing. Now, how many electrons are going to sit when it's neutral? 6. So that the atom has 6 electrons, and atom number 6 is called carbon. Atom number 8 is oxygen, and so on. Because the chemical properties depend upon the electrons on the outside, and that just depends upon how many electrons there are. So the chemical properties of substances depends only on a number, which is the number of electrons. And the whole list of elements of the chemists really should have been called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Instead of saying carbon, they should have said element 6, meaning 6 electrons. But of course, when they were first discovered, they didn't know that they could be numbered that way. And secondly, it would make everything look pretty complicated. It's good to have names for some of these things instead of calling everything by numbers. Instead of carbon dioxide would be 682 or something. 6 with 2 8s. It would be very confusing. Now, a little more was discovered about the electrical force. The natural interpretation of this electrical thing is that simply the two objects attract each other, plus against minus. But this was discovered to be an inadequate idea to represent it. More adequate to represent the situation was to say that the existence of the positive charge in some sense distorts the space or creates a condition in the space so that when we put the negative charge in, it feels a force. This potentiality for this disturbance of the space is called electric field. And when we put an electron where there's an electric field, we say it's pulled. So we have two rules. Charges make field, and charges in field are moved, have forces on them, instead of saying a direct interaction. The reason for this will become clear when we discuss the following phenomenon. If I were to take charge up a comb, say, with my little electrically, and then have a piece of paper at a distance and move the comb back and forth, of course the paper will respond by pointing always to the comb. If I shake it faster, it soon is discovered that the paper is a little bit behind, that the law is much more complicated than the direct force. There's a delay in its action. Incidentally, at the first stage, when you start to move just a little bit slowly, you find a complication, which is magnetism. Magnetic influences have to do with electricity in motion. So magnetism and electricity are really combined into one field. It's two different aspects of exactly the same thing. A changing electric field can't exist without magnetism. And further, when we go faster, we find that there's a delay, and if we move the charge further and further out, the delay is more and more. And then an interesting thing happens. Although the force between these two things should be go as inversely as the square of the distance, it is found when you're shaking it that the oscillating part extends very much further out than you would guess at first sight. What this is analogous to is something like this. If I have to pull something with a string and pull it to one side, well, it's a little hard to, that analogy is not very good. If I'm in, say, a tub of water, or a big pool of water, and there's something very close to me, then I can move that by pushing the water directly. And if you looked at the two objects, all you would see would be that I'm essentially pushing the object. There's some kind of interaction between the object. Of course, what I do is I disturb the water disturbs the object. And you would get a law that if you push a little bit, an object would move, but if it were further out, it would hardly move, because, of course, if I move the water here, it'd only do it locally. On the other hand, if I jiggle, a new phenomenon is set up in which the motion of the water here moves the water there and so on, and waves travel away, so that if I'm jiggling, there's an influence very much further out that's oscillatory that you can't understand from the direct interaction. And therefore, the idea of a direct interaction has to be replaced with the existence of the water, or what we call the electromagnetic field. And the waves in the electromagnetic field can carry waves, and these waves are light, for example. They're used in practice and radio broadcast, for another example. In fact, let me describe these things. These oscillatory waves can have various frequencies. It's the only thing that's different from one wave to another is the speed of oscillation. If I take that same comb and shake faster and faster and faster and faster and look at the effects, I get a whole series of different kinds of things which are all unified in one thing with only one number. The number here is the number of oscillations per second. The usual pickups that you get from the walls, from the electric currents in the walls and the usual circuits around here and so on, 60 cycles, let's say about 100 cycles. Those are ordinary electrical disturbances. But if you increase the frequency to this range, 500,000 or 500 kilocycles to 1,000 kilocycles is the frequency of oscillations of radio of electromagnetic waves, which are used for radio broadcast. You're on the air, they say. Of course, it's got nothing to do with the air. You can have radio broadcasts without any air. If you increase the frequency, you get in the range that's used for FM and TV. Go still further, and we use those waves, for instance, in practice, for radar. Still higher, we begin to not need any instrument to see the stuff. We can see it with the human eye. And then the variation of frequency from 5 times 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 15th, we see this, these waves, and we would see them. Our eye would respond to this oscillation of the comb if I could shake it so fast, as red light or blue light, or violet light, depending on the frequency. Going still below this frequency, we call it infrared. On the other side, we call it ultraviolet. The fact that we can see in that range makes that stuff no more impressive than any other part of the electromagnetic spectrum from a physicist's standpoint. But of course, from a human standpoint, it's very much more interesting. If we go up in higher frequency, we get to X-rays. The X-rays are nothing but high frequency, very high frequency light. Still higher, we get gamma rays. Actually, it's hard to distinguish these. It depends upon where they come from. It's not a good definition. Usually, gamma rays are light that comes, electromagnetic waves that come from nuclei, while X-rays come from atoms at high energy, but it's not very sharply defined. I mean, these are just names. You see, human beings trying to associate some names with numbers again. If we go to still higher frequencies, we find we make those waves artificially with the modern synchrotron, like the synchrotron here at Caltech, can get electromagnetic waves with that frequency. There are even electromagnetic waves of 1,000 times more rapid oscillation in the waves found in cosmic rays, which is something that we can't control. And I described already the idea of the electromagnetic field, that this field can have waves. But then it was soon learned that these waves behave in a strange way. They behave, when you get to the very highest frequencies, much more like a particle. Now, they're, of course, all the same. It's the quantum mechanics which is involved, which was the next discovery after 1920, which had to change all our views. The big discovery, in addition to the classical ideas, which has to be now made, is the quantum mechanics. Historically, the picture of space and time, I should go back and say this earlier. At the same time, about that time, the picture of space as a three-dimensional space and the time as separate was changed by Einstein first into a combination space-time, and then still further into a curved space-time, which was to represent the gravitation. So the stage is changed into space-time, and gravitation is presumably a modification of space-time. But the rules of the motions of particles turned out to be incorrect. The mechanical rules of inertia and forces, that's wrong. Newton's laws are wrong. Instead, there was discovered that things on a small scale behave like nothing on a large scale at all. That's what makes physics hard and very interesting. Because it's hard, because it's so unnatural the way things behave on a small scale, because we have no direct experience, because our experience is with things on a large scale. It behaves like nothing at all on a large scale. You say, the trouble with the teachers of physics is they don't explain quantum mechanics like this, that the particles behave like waves, or they behave like billiard balls, or they behave like I don't know what. But they don't behave like anything that you know of, you see. So it's impossible to describe the things except in analytic ways, and with a certain difficulty and taking a lot of imagination. Incidentally, the quantum mechanics has several aspects. In the first place, the idea that a particle has a definite location and a definite speed is no longer allowed. That's wrong. And to give a measure of how wrong classical physics is, there's a rule that says that you can't both know where something is and how fast it's moving. The uncertainty in the momentum of it and the uncertainty in the position are complementary. If your product of the two is a constant. If you want the law, you like to write equations, you can write this. But I will explain it some other time in more detail. This is the explanation of a very mysterious paradox. If the atoms are made out of plus and minus charges, why don't the minus charges simply sit on top of the plus charges? They attract each other. Why don't they just sit there on top? Why is our atom so big? Why, if there is a nucleus here and the electrons around? We first was thought that was because the nucleus was big. No. The nucleus is very small. The atom in its diameter here is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. The nucleus in its diameter is of the order 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. What does that mean? That means that if you had an atom and you wanted to see the nucleus, you'd have to expand it, magnify it, till the whole atom is the size of this room, and then the nucleus is a bare speck that you can just about make out with the eye, a hundredth of an inch across. And all the weight of the atom is in that infinitesimal nucleus. But what keeps the electrons from simply falling in? This principle. If they sat there, then you'd know where they were and that they weren't moving. And you can't have that. So they don't sit there, because if you try to put them there, they start moving around. Well, they move around and they take a compromise. They leave themselves a little room for this uncertainty and they jiggle at a certain amount of minimum motion given by this rule. You remember also that when a crystal is cooled to absolute zero, the atoms do not stop moving, they still jiggle. Why? Because if they stopped moving, you'd know where they were and that they had zero motion. And that's against the uncertainty principle. You're not supposed to know where they are and how fast they're moving. So they continually wiggle in there. Now, the most interesting consequence of quantum mechanics, however, not a consequence so much as a change of the philosophy and the ideas of science and physics, or not the ideas of science, but the ideas that people had in physics, is this. It is not possible to predict exactly what will happen in any circumstance. It is possible to arrange, for example, let's say an atom which is ready to emit light, and you measure when it's emitted light by picking up a photon, a particle, which I'll describe in a minute. You cannot predict when it's going to emit the light, or if you had several atoms, which one is going to. You say, oh, that's because there's some internal wheels that you haven't looked at close enough. No, there's no internal wheels. Nature is as we understand it today, is of this kind, that it's fundamentally impossible to make a precise prediction of exactly what is going to happen in a given experiment. This is a horrible thing. In fact, the philosophers have said before that one of the fundamental assumptions of science is that whenever you set up the same conditions, the same thing happens. Not true. It is not a fundamental condition of science. The fact is that the same thing doesn't happen, that we can get an average statistically as to what happens. But nevertheless, science has not completely collapsed. Philosophers say a great deal, incidentally, about what is absolutely necessary for science, and it's always, as far as I can see, rather naive and probably wrong. One of the things, for instance, that I've read that some philosopher or other said is it's fundamental to the scientific method that the same experiment, if you do a certain experiment in, say, Stockholm, and then you do the same experiment in Quito, the same results will occur. Quite false. It's not necessary for science for that. It may be a fact of experience, but it's not necessary. For instance, if one of the experiments is to look out at the sky and you see the aurora borealis in Stockholm, you don't see it in Quito. That's a different phenomenon. You say, oh, but that's something that has to do with outside. Can you close yourself up in a box in Stockholm and pull down the shades and then get any difference? There's an interesting phenomenon. If you take a pendulum on a support that can wobble either way, not just go in a plane, but a free support, universal joint up there, and pull it out and let go, then the pendulum swings almost in a plane, but it doesn't quite swing in a plane. It slowly, the plane keeps changing in Stockholm, not in Quito. The blinds are pulled down, too. The fact that this happens is not the destruction of science. I tell you what I believe that the fundamental hypothesis of science is, the fundamental philosophy. I wrote it as a summary in the first lecture, that the sole test of the validity of any idea is experiment. And if it turns out from experiment that most experiments work the same in Quito as they do in Stockholm, then those most experiments we will use to formulate some general laws. And those experiments which don't come out the same, we'll say, is the result of the environment near Stockholm or something. We'll invent some way to summarize the results of experiment. We don't have to be told ahead of time what it's going to look like. And if one of the things is, if they tell us that the certain situation must always produce the same result, that's all very well, but if when we try it, it doesn't occur, then it doesn't occur, and we just have to take what we see. So the fundamental philosophy is not any other thing than what we get from looking by experiment, and then we formulate all the rest of our ideas in terms of our experience, in terms of the subject on which we work. Anyhow, this quantum mechanics is difficult to understand, and it is not usually, your students don't learn it until the beginning, perhaps, of the third year. So for 2 years, they only worry about the things which I've mentioned up till now. But in this picture, I must describe everything, so I'll describe I can't tell you the details of the quantum mechanical principles, of course, that's too difficult. But I will just say, assume that they are there, just in a historical way, what some of the consequences are. And one of the consequences are that things which used to be waves also behave as particles, and particles behave as waves. In fact, everything behaves the same way. There's no distinction between a wave phenomenon and a particle phenomenon. And so the quantum mechanics unifies the idea of the field of waves and of particles all in one. Now, it's true that when the frequency is low, the field aspect of the phenomena are more accurate or more usually needed to describe it as an approximation for our usual experiences. As the frequency increases, we get the wave picture, but the more the frequency increases, the more the particle aspects of the phenomena stick out with the usual equipment that we use to make the measurements. And so, in fact, although I mentioned here all these frequencies have no phenomenon involving the frequency has yet been detected above approximately here. We only deduce the frequency in these from the energy of the particles by a rule, which assumes that the particle wave in quantum mechanical rules is still okay, so that this is an implied frequency, not a directly measured one. Now, then we have a new view of electromagnetic interactions. We have a new kind of a particle. First, by the way, we had some particles. One was the electron, another was the proton and the neutron, and now we have the electromagnetic field. But in the view of the quantum mechanics, we can describe the whole thing by one new particle, and that particle is called a photon. So we have another particle, a photon. You see? Now, the law which connects, or the interaction of electrons and photons, which is electromagnetic theory, with the quantum mechanical, everything quantum mechanically correct and so on, is called quantum electrodynamics. It's a horrible name, but what it is the fundamental theory of the interaction of light and matter, or electric field and charges. It is our greatest success in physics. In one theory, we have the basic rules for all ordinary phenomena, except for gravitation, which is an ordinary phenomenon. For example, a mechanical phenomena, Newton's laws come out of quantum electrodynamics, electrical laws come out, chemical laws come out, and so on. For instance, the laws of the collision of billiard balls, the motions of wires in magnetic field, the specific heat of carbon monoxide. the color of neon signs, the density of salt, the reactions of hydrogen and oxygen to make water, in fact, any chemical reactions, the color of copper and so on, are all consequences of this one law, set of laws called quantum electrodynamics. All these details can be worked out if the situation is simple enough for us to make the calculation, which is almost never. But most of the time, we can still figure out more or less what's happening. It depends on the circumstance, how complicated it is. Let's put it this way. At the present time, no exceptions are found to the quantum electrodynamic laws, as long as you stay out of the nucleus and so on. And there, we don't know whether it's an exception to the quantum electrodynamic laws or that we simply don't know what's going on in the nucleus. In principle, then, the quantum electrodynamics is a theory of all chemistry. And if life is ultimately reduced to chemistry and physics, and therefore just to physics, because chemistry is already reduced, the part of physics which is involved is already known. That is, all the laws that are necessary are known. Furthermore, the same quantum electrodynamics, this great thing, predicts a lot of things. In the first place, it tells the properties of very high-energy photons, gamma rays, and so on. It comes out right. Predicted a very remarkable thing also, that beside the electron, there should be another particle of the same mass but of opposite charge called positron, and that these two coming together could annihilate each other with the emission of light or gamma rays. I mean, after all, light, gamma rays, all the same. It's just on a scale. The existence of, for each particle, that there's an anti... The generalization of this, that for each particle there's an antiparticle, turns out to be true. In the case of electrons, the antiparticle has another name. It's called a positron. But for most other particles, they're simply called anti-so-and-so, like anti-proton or anti-neutron and so on. In this quantum electrodynamics theory, two numbers are put in, and all the rest of the numbers in the world are supposed to come out. The two numbers that are put in, I mean, not the world, it's limited, by the way. The two numbers that are put in are called the mass of the electron and the charge of the electron. Actually, that's not quite true. We have the whole series of extra numbers for chemistry, which tells how heavy all the nuclei are, and that leads us to the next problem. What are the nuclei made out of, and how are they held together? It's found that the nuclei are held together by enormous forces. When those are released, the energy releases are enormous compared to chemical energy, in the same ratio as the atomic bomb explosion is to a TNT explosion. Because, of course, one of them, the atomic bomb, has to do with changes inside the nucleus, while the explosion of TNT has to do with the changes of the electrons and the outsiders of the atom. The question is, what are the forces which hold the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus? Just like electrical interaction was due to can be represented in a way as the exchange of photons or electric field, well, there's an electric field between the two, and that these are connected to a particle, the photon, in quantum mechanics. So Yukawa suggested that the forces between neutrons and protons have also got a field of some kind, and that when this field jiggles, it behaves like a particle, and that there should be some other particles in the world besides proton and neutron, and was able to deduce the properties of these particles from the characteristics already known of nuclear forces. First, that they should have a mass of 200 or 300 times an electron and so on. And lo and behold, in cosmic rays, they discovered a particle of the right mass. But I won't chase around this. It was the wrong particle. It was called a mu meson, a muon. It's not the right particle. But a little bit later, in 1947 or 8, another particle was found, the pi meson, which satisfies Yukawa's criteria. So that beside the proton and the neutron, in order to get nuclear forces, we also have to add pi on. Now you say, oh, great. Now we just make the quantum electrodynamics with this theory. We make the quantum nucleodynamics using the pions and so on, just like Yukawa wanted to do, and see if it works, and everything will be explained. Bad luck. It turns out that the calculations that are involved in this theory, because of some differences in the numbers involved, are so great that no one has ever been able to figure out what the consequences are of this theory in order to check it against experiment. And this has been going on now for almost 20 years. And so we're stuck with a theory that we don't know whether it's right or wrong, but we know it's sort of wrong, or at least incomplete, because While we're dawdling around theoretically trying to calculate the consequences of this theory that we can't calculate because it's too hard to calculate, the experimenters are discovering some things, you see, unfortunately. For instance, I already discovered this mu meson or muon, and we don't know where it fits, so we don't want the extra particle, you see. In the meantime, also in cosmic rays, a large number of other extra particles were found. And so it turns out that today we have approximately 30-some-odd particles. And I've only written a few, you see, here. But there's some 30-some-odd particles, and it's very difficult to understand what the relation of all these particles are and what nature wants them for, or what the connections are from one to the other. We do not today understand these various particles as different aspects of the same thing, and the fact that we have so many unconnected particles is a representation of the fact that we have so much unconnected information, that we have not a good theory. So that after the great successes of the quantum electrodynamics, the rough successes, there is a certain amount of knowledge of nuclear physics that's sort of a rough knowledge, that from a sort of half experience and half theory, assuming some kind of a force between protons and neutrons and seeing what will happen, but not really understanding where the force comes from. But aside from that, we've made very little progress, and we've collected an enormous number of particles. But like the chemists who collected an enormous number of chemical elements, there suddenly appeared to be relations among these elements which were unexpected, like sodium and potassium are about the same in their chemical properties, in the Mendeleev chart. So we have a Mendeleev-type chart for the new particles. The Mendeleev chart of the new particles was made by Gell-Mann and Nishijima in Japan independently. And here are the particles. All I can do is just list them for you. It's no use telling you much more about them at this stage, but just to show you how much we don't know. So I'll show you the particles. Here is a neutron and proton. Underneath, you'll find the mass of these particles in a certain unit. This unit is called an MeV and is equal to 1.782 times 10 to the minus 27 grams. Why we chose this unit is historical, and I won't involve us in it now. But that's the unit in which all these masses, in other words, you multiply this by that, you'll get the mass of the proton in grams, if you need it in grams. But you can always use that unit if you want. Now, here's the neutron and the proton. They're almost the same mass, very, very close. In this chart, the layout of the chart is this way. In vertical columns, you put the things with the same electrical charge, all neutral objects in this column, all positively charged objects in this column, and all negatively charged objects in this column. Now, particles which go in this chart together with the neutron and proton, they're all called baryons, and the following particles exist. There's a lambda, whose mass is 1154. There are three others, sigmas, minus, neutral, and plus, with several masses, almost exactly the same. You see this chart, the mass sort of, as the particles that are heavier are written higher up, but you see that there are groups or multiplets with almost exactly the same mass. If you forget 1% or 2%, then exactly the same mass. So here's the first multiple as 2, and then there's a single multiplet with 1. And then here's a multiplet with 3, and above is a multiplet with 2, with nearly the same mass. This mass is not measured accurately here. I only think 2 or 3 of these have ever been seen. Now, very, very recently, within the last 6 months, a few extra particles have been found. Or are they particles? They live so short a time, they disintegrate almost instantaneously as soon as they're formed. If they disintegrate instantaneously as soon as they're formed, we wouldn't have to worry about them. But they disintegrate almost instantaneously, and so we almost have to worry about them, and we don't know whether or not they should be considered as new particles, in which case they would be called Y1, or some kind of a resonance of interaction at a certain energy between the products that it disintegrates into, which is a lambda and a pi. Since I didn't mention what a pion's, the properties of the pions yet, but there are three kinds, and so there are three of these Y's. So there's another multiplet up here. So that's one part of the chart. Now, the other particles which are involved in nuclear interactions are first the pions, as Yukawa wanted, and they come in three varieties. Positive, negative, and neutral. And there's another multiplet. Now I found some new things called K-mesons, and they occur here's a pair here, K minus and K naught bar, and then at exactly the same energy as K naught and K plus. Incidentally, I forgot to say, every particle has its antiparticle, except. For instance, the pi minus and the pi plus are antiparticles, but the pi zero is its own antiparticle. The K minus and the K plus are antiparticles, and the K naught and K naught bar are antiparticles. In addition, in this chart, we have also got some, in the last 6 months, some more particles, or, you know, maybe particles, the same way as up here that disintegrate almost immediately. A thing called an omega, which goes into three pions, has a mass 780 on this scale. And then, somewhat less certain, is an object which disintegrates into two pies. And then, if I wanted to continue this chart by putting double question marks, I could increase the number of dotted lines rather by three or four more. But I don't want to go to such double question marks yet. But we'll let you know at the end of the year whether there are some more dotted lines. All of these particles, these are called the mesons, and those are called the baryons. The mesons and their antiparticles are the same, but the antiparticles of the baryons must be put on a chart over here, backwards. Everything written anti, 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 all the charges reversed and so on. Now, just like Mendeleev's chart was very good, except there were a number of rare earth elements which were hanging out loose from the chart. So we have a number of things hanging out loose from the chart. Particles which do not interact strongly in nuclei, that have nothing to do with a nuclear interaction, and do not have a strong interaction. I mean a very powerful, the kind of powerful interaction of nuclear energy. And those are, they have electrical interactions or other interactions, but those are called leptons. And they are of the following. There's the electron, which has the mass very small on this scale. See, 0.510 and so on. This is 938. That's almost 1,836 times heavier than an electron. That's the nucleus is so much heavier than the rest of the atom. Then there's this other thing, the mu minus meson, the muon or mu meson, which has a mass much higher, 200 and something times as heavy as an electron. As far as we can tell by all experiments so far, the difference between the electron and the mu meson is nothing but the mass. Everything works exactly the same for the mu as it does for the electron, except that one is heavier than the other. Why is there another one heavier? What's the use of it? In addition, there's a particle, a lepton, which is neutral and is called a neutrino and has zero mass. These masses are the masses of the particles at rest. Finally, we have two other particles which do not interact strongly with these nuclear things. One is the photon, and perhaps if gravity is also, if the field of gravity has also got a quantum mechanical analog, a quantum gravitation, which has not yet been worked out, then there will be a particle, a graviton, which will have also zero mass. What is this zero mass? These masses given here are the masses of the particles at rest. The fact that it has zero mass means, in a way, it can't be at rest. And a photon is never at rest, but is always moving at 186,000 miles a second. So we can't, the mass, we'll understand better what the mass at rest means when we understand the theory of relativity, which will come in due time. This, then, is the horrible condition of our physics today. To summarize it, I would say this. Outside the nucleus, we seem to know it all. Inside, quantum mechanics is okay. The principles of quantum mechanics have not been found to fail. So if we write down the stage of, on which we put, into which we put all of our knowledge, we would say it's space-time, the relativistic space-time. Perhaps gravity is involved in the space-time. We don't know the initial conditions, and we don't know how the thing got started, the whole universe got started, so we don't know that part. And we have never made experiments which check our ideas of space and time accurately below this tiny distance. So we only know that this idea works beyond that distance. We also add the rules of the game on the quantum mechanical principles. And those quantum mechanical principles apply, as far as we can tell, equally well to the new particles as they do to the old particles. But the origin of forces problem in nuclei leads us to new particles, but they appear, unfortunately, in great profusion without a complete understanding of their interrelations, although there are some very surprising relationships among them. I don't have time to explain the use of this chart in predicting various reactions, and perhaps we would come back to that a different time. Thank you.
This lecture, The Relation of Physics to Other Sciences, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on October 3, 1961, at the California Institute of Technology.
Today I want to talk to you about the relation of physics to the other sciences. If we look out from physics, which of course is the center of the universe, and see what surrounds us, we're going to look out today from physics and see what surrounds us. For physics has a profound effect on all the other sciences, so that students of many fields find themselves studying it. In addition, I'll take this opportunity to explain what the fundamental problems are in the other sciences and how they're getting along with them. So we'll do two things. Now, naturally, all of this is absolutely impossible to do in 45 minutes. So I'm going to apologize from the beginning for the cursory way in which I'm going to deal with the complex, the subtle, and the beautiful matters in the other subjects. I should like also to have dealt with the relation of physics to engineering, industry, society, and war, but I haven't got the time to deal with these things. Why, neither do I have the time to discuss the most remarkable relationship between mathematics and physics. Mathematics is not a science from my point of view. In a sense, it's not a natural science. It's an unnatural science, perhaps. Incidentally, may I say from the beginning that if a thing is not science, it is not necessarily bad. For example, love is not a science. So there's nothing, if something is said not to be a science, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with it. It just means it isn't science. Because science is good, let's say. It doesn't mean that which is not science is not good, if you know how to reason. The science which has perhaps been most deeply affected by physics is the science of chemistry. Historically, the early days of chemistry was a study of what we call now inorganic chemistry, the substances that were found not associated with living things in the rocks and so on. And there was a considerable analysis of it to discover the existence of elements and their relationships to making various relatively simple compounds. The early chemistry was very important for the physics. The interaction was very great right at the beginning because the theory of atoms was substantiated to a large extent by the experiments in chemistry. But the theory of chemistry, that is, the reactions themselves, were summarized to a large extent in the periodic chart of Mendeleev, which showed some strange relationships between the various elements. And it was a collection of rules as to which substances combine with which and how, which constituted the big inorganic chemistry. All these rules were ultimately explained in principle by quantum mechanics. That is, the characteristics of the periodic table can be understood from physics by understanding what the atom is, how it's made up of protons and electrons obeying quantum mechanics. So that the theoretical chemistry is, in fact, physics. On the other hand, this explanation, I say, is in principle. And we've already discussed the difference between knowing the rules of the game of chess and being able to play. And so it is that we may know the rules, but we can't play too well. It turns out to be very difficult to be really able to predict in detail precisely what will happen in a given chemical reaction. But nevertheless, the deepest part of theoretical chemistry must end up in quantum mechanics. There is a branch of physics and chemistry which were developed together by both sciences, which is extremely important, which is called statistical mechanics. And that was involved because in any chemical situation, very large numbers of atoms are involved. And we've seen that the atoms are all jiggling around in a very random manner, in a very complicated way. If we would analyze each collision and be able to follow how every molecule went, of course, we could figure out what would happen. But the number of numbers needed to keep track of all these molecules exceeds enormously the capacities of any machines, and certainly before machines, computing machines existed, the capacity of the mind. And therefore, it was important to develop a method of dealing with such complicated situations. And this is the method of statistics applied in the situation in which there are mechanical laws, which is then called statistical mechanics, and was developed by both sciences together. This statistical mechanics is a theory of the phenomena of heat or thermodynamics. So inorganic chemistry is now almost finished in its main problems, aside from, of course, its industrial applications and so on, but as a science. It is now reduced essentially to what is now called physical chemistry and quantum chemistry. That is to study the rates at which reactions occur. Do they agree with the principles of statistical mechanics? What essentially is happening in detail? How do the molecules hit? And which pieces fly off first and so forth? And the quantum chemistry to calculate whether we can understand what happens in terms of the physical laws. The other branch of chemistry is organic chemistry, and that's the chemistry of the substances which are associated with living things. And incidentally, for a while, it was believed that the substances which were associated with living things were so marvelous that they could not be made by hand from inorganic materials, but this is not at all true. They're just the same as the substances made by the inorganic chemist, only more complicated arrangements of the atoms are involved. Organic chemistry obviously has a very close relationship to the biology which supplies the substances and to industry. And furthermore, much physical chemistry and quantum chemistry can be applied here too, to organic compounds as well as inorganic compounds. But the main problems of organic chemistry are not there, but rather to analyze and to synthesize and to reproduce the substances which are in the biological systems, in living things. And this leads, as you go into it in more detail, imperceptibly in steps toward biochemistry and then into biology itself, or molecular biology. And it's very hard to draw the line. I'll come to this subject of biochemistry later. Now I turn my attention to another science, the science of biology, which is the study of living things. In the earliest days of biology, it was the problem of finding out what living things there were. And so you just had to count the hairs on the limbs of a flea. But after that was worked out, a great deal of interest went into the machinery inside the living bodies, from a grosser standpoint, naturally, because it takes some effort to get into the finer details. In fact, this interesting relationship between physics and biology there, in which biology helped physics, was a discovery of the conservation of energy, I believe, was first demonstrated best by Mayer, the amount of heat taken in and left out by a living creature. If we look at the processes of biology of living animals more closely, we see the circulation of the blood, all right, there's pumps, there's pressure, there's so forth. And then there are nerves. I know what's happening when I tickle, when I step on a sharp stone. And somehow or other, the information gets from the leg up, and that's an interesting thing how that happens. The study of nerves has led to the conclusion that nerves are a kind of very fine tube of living cell material in here with a complex wall that's very thin. And that it pumps ions so that there are positive ions on the outside and negative on the inside, or vice versa. I never can remember anything like that. And the thing is all ready to discharge. Now, this membrane has an interesting property. If it discharges in one place, that is, if some of the ions may be able to move through in one place so that the electric voltage is reduced there, that electrical influence makes itself felt in the ions in the neighborhood, and that affects the membrane in such a way that it lets the ions through there. And so in letting the ions through there, it affects it further along and so forth. And so there's a wave of penetrability, you might say, of the membrane which runs down the fiber when it's excited at one end by stepping on a sharp stone. This wave is somewhat analogous, of course, to a pile of vertical stone, tiles, start up this way, and you push the end one, and that pushes the next, and so on. But that'll only carry one message, unless the stones are put up again. And so in this living cell, There are processes which pump the ion slowly back out again and get the cell, the nerve ready for the next impulse. And so it is that I know what I'm doing. I mean, at least I know what I'm, where I am. The opposite end, when the nerves send impulses, incidentally, of course, there are electrical effects associated with this nerve impulse, and you can pick them up with electrical instruments. Naturally, I give this as an example because since it's electrical effects, obviously the physics has had of electrical effects has had a great deal of influence on understanding it. In fact, it's so obvious that physics is so inextricably involved in everything that I won't repeat that anymore. Since everything is made out of the atoms, and since the atom's machinery is the laws of physics, there's no way to keep the thing separated. The opposite effect is if in somewhere in the brain the message is sent out along a nerve, what happens when it gets to the end of the nerve? There the nerve branches out into fine little effect, little things, and it's connected to some kind of a structure near a muscle called an end plate. And off the end of the nerve, for reasons and in a manner that's not exactly understood, when the impulse reaches the end, little blobs, little packets of a chemical are shot off. Not atoms or molecules, but little groups of 5 or 10 molecules at a time in a packet of acetylcholine are shot off, and they affect the muscle fiber and make it contract. How simple. What makes a muscle contract? A muscle is an awful large number of fibers close together containing two different substances, myosin and actomycin or something like that. I don't remember the names. And the machinery by which the chemical reactions which are changed by the acetylcholine is able to modify the dimensions of the molecule are not known. In other words, the fundamental processes in the muscle that makes mechanical motion is not known. There are, of course, biology is such an enormously wide field. There's a host of other problems, and I can't mention them at all. Problems like how vision works, what the light does in the eye, how hearing works, for example, and so on. With regard to how thinking works, I'll discuss that later on under psychology. Now, these things that we've just discussed are, from a biological standpoint, really not fundamental or basic or way down in the bottom of all of life. In the sense that if you understood them, you still wouldn't understand life itself. You know? Because, to illustrate, for all the men who are studying nerve and say it's very important, nerves, because after all, you can't have animals without nerves, but you can have life without nerves because the plants have no nerves and they have no muscles, but they're working, they're alive just as much. So in the fundamental processes of biology, we have to look deeper. And then it's discovered that all living things have some great things in common, and therefore there is a common deep biological subject, because there are many, many things that are common to all living things. So now I turn to those things which are common to all living things. The most common feature is that they're made of cells. And in the cells is a vast machinery for doing things chemically. In the plant cells, for example, there's a machinery for picking up light and then keep generating sucrose, or energy, and then generating sucrose, which in the dark is then consumed to keep the thing alive. And that generates a series of chemical reactions in a vast and complicated cycle. The phenomena of respiration in animals is extremely closely related to the photosynthesis and its opposite effect in the dark in plants. And so in all the systems, in all the cells, there are these elaborate chemical reactions in which one compound is changed into another. You can't see it from back there. But to give you some impression of the enormous efforts that have been gone into the study of biochemistry, the chemistry of biological processes, there's some charts here which summarize all the knowledge of today on the series of reactions which occur in cells. Now, these charts are so small scale, I appreciate, that you can't make it out at all. And in order to help you out, I've taken one piece of this chart, which is down here. That's just this one piece. And I magnified it so you can see it on the blackboard over here. Now, I don't want you to learn this. You're going to learn this when you study biochemistry. But I want you to get the impression of what is known and the complexities that there are in living things. There are a whole series of chemicals, that a certain molecule that keeps changing in a rather small way. To go from here to here, you simply add an OH and so on. And it goes around a cycle, as you see, called the Krebs cycle, the respiratory cycle. Each one of these steps, each of these chemicals is fairly simple itself. But each one of these steps, and this is the centrally important feature of bio that's discovered in biochemistry, each one of these steps is relatively difficult to accomplish in a laboratory. If you have the one substance and the other substance, it just doesn't turn from one into the other. It's hard to get it apart. If you have the molecule, if you wanted to add the OH, it takes a certain energy to get it on. Although when it's on, it likes to be there. It's something like this. If I wanted to take an object from here to here, it would be okay if I could push it over the top. So most chemical reactions don't occur because there's what's called an activation energy in the way. In order to add the substance to the chemical, requires essentially to push on and get it close enough so that some rearrangement can occur, and then it'll stick. But if you can't give it enough energy to get it close enough, it won't go. It'll just go up and come back. So most of these reactions don't go because of this. But if you could take those chemicals in your hand, those substances in your hand, and just pull it just back or open a hole and let the other thing in and another snap back or however it is built, then you could find another way around which wouldn't require that, and the reaction could go easily. Though there are in the cells very large molecules, enormous things, these are very small molecules that involve perhaps this many atoms, half of this model. But the large molecules, this is not one, but it may contain more atoms even than that, in some complicated way just comes around this thing and holds it just right so the next reaction can occur. And these very large and complicated things are called enzymes. They were first called ferments because the first discovery of them was in the fermentation of sugar and making wine and so on, that the first ferments were discovered. And the first series of reactions, some of the reactions, in fact, in this very cycle were first discovered there. In the presence of an enzyme, a reaction will go. An enzyme is made out of another substance called protein, which I'll explain in a minute how the enzymes look. But they're very big and complicated, and they control reactions. And every one of them is different. And each one is built to control a certain special reaction. So the names of the enzymes are written here at each reaction. Sometimes the same enzyme may run two reactions, but here they are going around the cycle. These words represent some big lump of stuff that comes in and lets it go from here to here. The enzymes themselves are not involved in the reaction directly. They don't change. They just come and let this go from here to here, and they come back, and they're ready to do it to the next molecule. In other words, like a machine, a factory. There's a machine. Thing goes in, boom, boom, comes out. During all this process, there has to be a supply of certain atoms. For example, there may be a removal of hydrogen here and here or here. And there are special substances which carry complicated enzymes which have a little special unit on it which carries the hydrogen for all the chemical reactions. There are three or four, for example, hydrogen or reducing enzymes which are used all over the cycle in different places. And so what's interesting is that the machinery, for instance, which liberates some hydrogen here, will take that hydrogen and use it somewhere else. In fact, the photosynthetic process is one which transforms this form to that form, and thus it's able to run the cycle. The light is what ultimately does that somewhere else in the cell. And then this substance comes over here, wherever this place is where this happened, and runs that cycle. The most important feature of the cycle is right here, the transform from GDP, the GTP, it used to be called ADP and ATP, guanidine diphosphate to guanidine triphosphate. It used to be thought to be adenine diphosphate to adenine triphosphate, but it's the same. This is